Today's episode is brought to you by Surfshark. Today, with practically everything being done online, your online privacy is paramount, and you can enjoy peace of mind knowing that your online privacy is improved and protected from hackers 24/7 by the award-winning Surfshark. How? Well, their main product, VPN, basically acts as a shield, so when your device connects to the internet, all that information is, in a way, encrypted, so anyone who tries to snoop on you won't be able to see what you're doing or where you're doing it all from. Everything you do online stays private. Its antivirus offers powerful device protection, securing everything from your webcam to your files. Alternative ID can generate a new online identity and proxy email for you. Surfshark Alert enhances your security further with instant data leak notifications, and you can even browse ad-free without digital footprints using the Surfshark search engine. Plus, if you use a VPN, you can virtually travel the world from the comfort of your own home, and Surfshark gives you more than 100 countries to choose from. Once you change your virtual location, you'll be able to bypass censorship and restrictions, find your favourites on Netflix, Hulu, Disney Plus or other streaming services, and even access new libraries to watch even more content. Say, you can't see a YouTube video because of your location. Use Surfshark VPN. Struggling to access that website to buy limited edition goods? Use Surfshark VPN. Try it today, totally risk-free, with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Secure your privacy with Surfshark. Enter coupon code TRUECRIMEPOD for an extra 3 months free at surfshark.deals/truecrimepod. Yes, 3 months free. That's surfshark.deals/truecrimepod. Hello all, and the very warmest of welcomes to the True Crime Enthusiast podcast, North Wales' premier one person and his cat true crime show that seeks to bring lesser covered tales from the darkest corners of the UK and Ireland. Doing so is myself, Paul, the creator, host and true crime enthusiast of the show's title. The hairy football, Pixie, the true crime enthusiast cat, is here with me as ever. And completing us are yourselves, the wonderful enthusiasts that make the show go around. It is amazing as ever having you join us today, which I thank you kindly for, and I hope that as you have, then it's for an episode that finds you and yours all good, all safe, and all well. Right then, for the concluding part of the opening tale of Series 9. Now if you haven't yet heard the first part of Triangle of Terror, then please head back and listen to that one first, or else this episode will make as much sense as the appeal of Love Island All Stars does to me, which is absolutely bugger all. I hope North Korea begin to use it for missile practice, I really do. If you have heard the first part, then just a quick recap in a nutshell. I've begun this series by describing the exploits of an individual who throughout the late spring and summer of 1984 inflicted terror on a section of southern England. Beginning as a prolific burglar, the individual came to be known as the Fox, a moniker given due in part to his stealth and cunning, but also due to his behaviour once inside a property. The Fox's MO was to either burgle his victims while they were not at home, often having observed the properties he planned to target in advance, and spending considerable time in the property, where he would steal all manner of items, would study family photographs, sometimes take them away with him, would take food from the fridge, and would even settle down to watch television and videotapes. Now, what led to the intruder gaining the nickname The Fox was his habit of constructing dens from blankets and furniture in the properties that he targeted, ostensibly so he could watch television without the glare of the TV attracting the attention of passers-by. Now, whilst this sounds strange and disturbing behaviour, it wasn't a patch to the horrors of when he would break into a property while the occupants were asleep. In these latter instances, the victims would typically wake to the terrifying sight of the intruder, a man of average height, wearing gloves and masked in a dark homemade hood. The fact that he had no face, just mere slits for eye holes, made him seem extra sinister. But far more menacing was the shotgun that he held pointed at them, a weapon stolen from an earlier burglary. He would then subdue the occupants with their own clothing, ties, belts, scarves and shoelaces, before committing either a sexual assault upon them or a rape, usually on a female, but had also assaulted a male, and would then make his getaway across open countryside. He wasn't afraid to use violence in his attacks either, as he would use the shotgun as a club in the case of non-compliance, and one homeowner had even been shot, causing a life-changing injury to him. The attacks left the people of three counties in a state of near hysteria, and the fox showed no signs of stopping. In fact, in July of that year, he was to commit his most horrific attack yet. But time was running out for him, as I shall explain in the concluding part of Triangle of Terror right now. The episode contains details and descriptions of crimes and events, including descriptions of a sexual nature and descriptions of animal mistreatment that some listeners may find disturbing and or distressing, so please use discretion whilst you're listening in. Bearing that in mind, please join the True Crime Enthusiasts for the second and concluding part of Triangle of Terror for an episode I have entitled Snared. Following the spate of burglaries and sexual attacks I described in the first episode, Fox Hunt, from mid-July 1984, the Fox focused his perverted attention onto the Buckinghamshire village of Edlesborough, where he committed more burglaries, or attempted to, anyway. On the evening of the 11th of July, one woman saw him outside her home and raised the alarm, causing him to flee. One account claims that the following night, the fox broke into another two properties in the same village, just 18 houses apart, hiding in the latter where the owners were away, whilst police were at the former. He returned to the village again in the early hours of the following day, Friday the 13th of July, breaking into the home of Mike and Jane Jansen, though he was disturbed by the barking of their spaniel, Holly. Mike awoke to see the fox fleeing through his kitchen window, though he was away by the time Mike managed to get downstairs and outside. He had seen the fox unmasked, though could offer little else to the general description police had of the man, only able to describe him as wearing a dark and white striped top and straight-legged jeans. Now, you can only imagine what the police presence must have been in such a small village after such fox activity on consecutive nights, can't you? And subsequently, you'd think he'd shy well away from there, wouldn't you? Well, you'd be wrong, for later that Friday the 13th, the fox returned to Edlesborough for his most horrific attack yet. Late that evening, he attempted to get into another house there, but was disturbed by the householder, who almost caught the fox, trapping his leg in a door that he'd slammed, although the fox wriggled free. Now, rather than flee the area following this abortive attempt, as he made his way through the shadows of the village, the fox was drawn by the faint sounds of music being played, soon locating the bungalow that it was coming from, where inside, with her parents on holiday in America, were an 18-year-old girl, her 17-year-old brother, and the girl's 21-year-old boyfriend. The following account is told largely in the victim's own words, as they bravely told the Daily Mirror national newspaper only days later, though due to sensitivity, the names of those concerned have never been revealed publicly. The following does make for disturbing listening. It was the girl's boyfriend who first came face to face with the fox. Wearing only his underwear, he and his girlfriend had been in bed, though reports are they were sleeping apart, when he heard a noise in the bungalow and went to investigate. He recalled later, I saw someone go across the end of the hallway into the kitchen. I didn't get a clear look, and I thought it was one of the other two. I walked into the kitchen, and it was then I saw a reflection in the window of someone standing hidden from me. I started to make my way to my pal's room, but then the man leapt out wearing a balaclava and pointing a shotgun at my head. I was in a state of total shock. I thought he was going to shoot me because I knew immediately who he was. His girlfriend, meanwhile, continued. I went to bed about midnight and left the other two still up talking about cars. Later, I heard them go to bed and I lay there dozing. Both boys were in bed listening to records. Then, I heard someone moving about. I thought it might be my boyfriend. We were getting over a tiff, so I went down to the kitchen to talk to him. Wearing only a thigh-length shirt and her underwear, the girl made her way to the kitchen when suddenly she was confronted with the terrifying sight of a man masked in a green hood, iron mouth holes crudely cut out of it, stood in the hallway in front of her, pointing a shotgun at her. He then ushered her and her boyfriend, who in her terror she had just registered was stood there also, into the bedroom where her younger brother was still playing records. The girl continued. I was stunned, but I didn't cry out. I just said, "Oh." We went into the room and lay on our backs, but he made us turn over. The man was so calm and confident, and it was that which terrified us. He never once raised his voice. It was chilling, because you knew straight away that he would kill without the slightest hesitation. He was just so casual, even in the way he tied up me and my boyfriend. By then, I was petrified, but even so, I remember that when he turned off a record that was playing, my brother moaned that he liked that particular song, and I smiled. I thought we were going to die. I knew I was going to get raped. I said to the others, "Should I run?" The fox had tied all three up, partly using their clothing, but also by using the flex that was torn from a standard lamp that was in the bedroom, from the base of which police were later able to glean a clear impression of his footwear where he had stood on it to brace himself to remove the wiring. Leaving the two men tied up on the floor, he laid the tied up girl on the bed and placed a pillowcase over the girl's face before leaving the room. She continued. I remember laying there wondering what it would feel like to be shot in the stomach, for this man would kill without hesitation. Then I heard a kettle boiling, and I wondered if he was going to scald me. Quite the opposite. The fox was partaking in his usual routine of raiding the household fridge, and the sound of the kettle was of him making himself some coffee. He then headed back into the room. The girl continued. I could hear him undressing, and then he raped me. He didn't hurt me. He was quite gentle, and I even think he was trying to be considerate. He even made sure my hands were not too tightly bound, and that I could breathe properly. Later, he left to make himself a cup of coffee in the kitchen. The fox then indeed went back to the kitchen, made himself another coffee, and this time, he even took time to eat some jam sandwiches. She went on. Afterwards, I was worried about my brother and my boyfriend. I knew they would want to do something, that they might be feeling guilty, and I let them know I was all right. I managed to touch my brother's arm. I just wanted to reassure him. I even joked that I could hear him doing the washing up, because I just wanted to reassure them I was okay and coping. I knew my boyfriend's pride had been hurt, and he would want to protect me. He must have been going through all sorts of agonies, but I didn't want him to try anything. The fox then returned to the room, and for some reason known only to himself, replaced the pillowcase that covered her head with a pair of underpants. He had also brought the family's Labrador dog in with him. He then raped the girl for a second time, and at gunpoint, in a quiet yet firm voice, the unmistakable northeast accent shining through. He then ordered both the girl's boyfriend and her brother to have intercourse with her, though neither could or did through abhorrence despite their fear. Instead, weeping, both merely simulated the act. The fox then also made an attempt to excite the family dog, stimulating it in an attempt to get it to penetrate the girl, but instead, the dog ran off. After then ransacking the bungalow, stealing some videotapes, including The Thing and National Lampoon's Animal House, and cutting the telephone wires, he then left the property and melted back into the darkness that he came from. Their ordeal had lasted almost 3 hours. Now, I know it isn't a particularly appealing thought, but just try to imagine the scene, the terror that must have been felt by the three victims, and the revulsion at what this man did and tried to get them to do. Try also to conceive of having to live the rest of your life with the horrific, degrading memories of what had just happened etched into your mind. You just can't, can you? Horrific beyond belief, that, isn't it? After a few agonizing moments, when they were certain that the fox had gone, the three managed to free themselves and at 3:52 a.m. notified police, who were, of course, already in the village, still looking for the fox following his abortive attempt of the previous evening. As she was cared for by relatives, a mother and father were contacted, and by the following day were on their way home from America. Now, this is one courageous and frankly quite amazing woman, for this interview that I've just taken this account from was given just 3 days after such an ordeal, and aside from recounting what you've heard here, she spoke quite frankly about how she was coping and urged people not to be heroes should they come across this man, not to have a go, because he readily would kill, saying, "No one should try to tackle this man because they would be killed. It's easier for a woman to get over a rape than to bring someone back from the dead. There are people who can help a girl to get over being raped, and who can help boyfriends and brothers to get over feelings of guilt. I have marvellous parents who have surrounded me always in love and security. Because of them, and the way my boyfriend is helping me, as well as through help from my friends and neighbours, I can cope with what has happened. The day after this happened, I went to the village pub with my family. There is no point in trying to lock yourself away and pretend it didn't happen. Now, I've got to get on with trying to live my life, and I must think about secretarial exams that are coming up. I'm lucky in that I can put this behind me. I only really cried for the first time last night when I learned that someone had heard something suspicious in the village. It petrified me to think the man may still be nearby." It's quite a remarkable statement that must have taken her some strength to deliver that, isn't it? Her boyfriend added, "I am so proud of her for the way she has stood up to everything and not cracked. It has brought us closer together." An inspirational woman indeed, one who reminded me of someone we met several series ago in the episode Evil at Ealing Vicarage, Jill Soward. Now, the girl was right, for the night before the interview was given, villager Alan Kempster spotted a shadowy figure prowling about by a house in the village before the figure was startled and then fled away over the fields. The girl and her family went to stay elsewhere for a while, and such was the lasting horror of that night that they even demolished and renovated part of the bungalow, ridding themselves of the room where such evil had occurred. In contrast to how commendably the girl was dealing with coping with her ordeal, as you've just heard, her father naturally wanted the fox's blood. He was quoted by a national newspaper as saying, "I hope and pray that this man is not taken alive. The sensible thing to do with him is to shoot him. If someone else is not prepared to do it, I would have no hesitation in pulling the trigger. It might sound a callous thing to say, but what he put my daughter through is the act of a mad dog, and mad dogs are put down. Why put the taxpayer to the expense of a prison sentence? It's an unnecessary burden on society. Now again, put yourself in said shoes. It is an understandable sentiment, this, isn't it? The victim was in October of the following year awarded £10,000 by the Criminal Injuries Compensation Board, a sum denounced as paltry by the group Women Against Rape. Now, I don't know if for such horror you can put any kind of price on compensation, really, for no amount would surely ever be enough, and how this sum of £10,000 was arrived at isn't reported. Now, I mentioned in the previous episode the grip of fear that the counties of Buckinghamshire, Bedfordshire and Hertfordshire were already placed in by this guy. But following the horror of this, and the prolificity and sheer brazenness of the fox to strike in the same area night after night, dancing in and out of police cordons, well, it sent it to near hysteria. Christopher Keane from Leighton Buzzard many years later recalled the fear that residents lived in during that summer, saying, "Back then, Leighton Buzzard was just a small little market town. Everyone knew everyone. Then, all of a sudden, the whole place is swarming with armed police. I remember hanging around the town and getting stopped by armed police in boiler suits, asking, 'Who are we and where are we going?' There was an air of suspicion across about anyone and everyone in the town. Everyone was a suspect, not just to the police, but to your neighbours. If someone was out at night, you'd start to think about why that was. It was a very hot summer, but I remember lying in bed in a sweltering house because no one dared open a window or door in case the fox came in. Everyone around the town fortified their premises. My parents put in security lights and a ton of locks on the doors. If you were asleep and you heard any noise in the house, you began to fear the worst. And certainly in mine and my friends' families, we were all sleeping with knives next to our bed. Everyone weaponized their home in some way." Now, as a point of note, following his arrest, it transpired that a friend of Christopher's had actually met and worked with the fox once before on a building job, and who he described as a quiet lad, saying that when he saw on the news the fox's identity, it was a job to believe it was true. Then 19-year-old Tracy Bailey, meanwhile, recalled later, "We were living in a kind of siege. After the triple attack, I wouldn't go out for 3 weeks, and even then, I wouldn't stay out late. People were absolutely terrified, and it took a long time for village life to return to normal. The effect still lingers on. I still take all the care and precautions I did when he was on the loose." Worst affected was Edlesborough and its surrounding villages, of course. Families took to sleeping in the same room every night. Many people living alone in the villages stayed with friends, and one group of people even spent the night following the triple attack, sleeping in a local pub. Children didn't play out in the street, and some parents even took their children out of school so they could get away from the village. The area was deserted at night, and several house buyers pulled out of deals, the village now tarnished to them. Hardware stores did a roaring trade as frightened villagers locked down every window and every door. Some would even remove doorknobs of a night, and others took to improvising traps inside to alert them to any intruder. From leaving boards studded with nails underneath windows, to scattering toy cars, Lego and action figures on windowsills. People also weaponized themselves, and there was barely a villager who didn't have a brick or a knife or hammer or makeshift club underneath their bed. Bar staff at the Axe and Compass Village pub, Madeline Lawrence, summed up everyone's feelings, saying at the time, "You will never be able to understand fully what it means to the village to know this man has been caught." Villager Sally Roots added, "People are totally fearful. They are sleeping with everything under their pillows, bits of wood, iron bars, you name it. Some people have even screwed down their windows and put special locks on their doors. Nobody will rest easy, particularly if they're living on their own, until this devil is caught." And some even went further, as was recalled by then villager Greg Cook, who said, years later, "My parents were so concerned that they put screws into the windows, and my mother balanced a saucepan on a pile of books by the front door, so we'd be wakened if anybody tried to get in. I insisted on having my shotgun by my bed, because it was the only thing to do." Another villager, Lisa Horgan, recalled, "We had new locks fitted everywhere, and one night after we had a strange telephone call, I slept with my mum because I was so scared, and my father slept in the other room. My mother was quite petrified throughout the whole period, and quite honestly, you started suspecting everybody, even your friends." During researching this tale, I've been in touch with several people who have recounted similar tales, having lived in the areas at the time, and equally, I've come across several accounts of false alarms, the ones that show the fear that the fox had instilled, for every single noise, every shadow was attributed to him. For example, police were called one night to a homeowner who had heard noises outside and had shot at the fox, only to find it was a pair of mating hedgehogs. Another tale involves a then 18-year-old living in Leighton Buzzard, who was at home alone for the weekend, and who returned home from a night out with friends to find lights on, knowing she hadn't left any on, the television blaring away, and perhaps most frightening of all, the downstairs bath half filled with water, with heavily blood-stained clothing in it. Convinced immediately that it was the fox, the girl grabbed a pair of scissors and a carving knife, and in true horror film fashion, crept further into the house, only to discover her brother face down asleep on the sofa. Now, having been camping with friends, he'd had too much to drink, cut himself quite badly on some glass, and had decided to come home early. When he got home, put his blood-stained clothes into the bath to soak, and had fallen asleep on the sofa, watching television. Now, admitting the next day that it was an amusing tale she would recount to friends, she also admitted that she'd never been that scared before that moment, or since. It just kind of shows the level of public fear at the time, doesn't it? And it wasn't just limited to the public either. The police hunting him too had their own fears. Detective Constable Richard Hanks and his family, an officer who will come into the tale a bit more somewhat later on, at the time lived near to Edlesborough, and because he was part of the team hunting the fox, the officer was forced to spend long periods away from his wife Linda and their then 2-year-old son, Matthew. DC Hanks recalled later, "I often had to leave my wife in tears. She was often on her own with our son and no one to protect her. Other wives at least knew their husbands would be home at night, but my job meant I would be away for up to 16 hours at a time. There were occasions when Linda just sat on the stairs at home clutching a hammer because she was so scared. If she heard a noise outside and I wasn't there, she would be frightened out of her life. I had to split myself in two. I wanted to catch him desperately and at the same time, protect my own wife and family." It's difficult to imagine such a wave of fear, isn't it? Now, reportedly, the fox, perhaps feeling he'd finally chanced his luck there once too often, seeing as he was now officially Britain's most wanted, moved away from Edlesborough and committed a series of burglaries in the Milton Keynes area of Buckinghamshire, but no sexual offences were reported, and until mid-August, he went to ground. It transpired later that he was away on holiday in Scotland for part of this period, but he was certainly back late in the evening of the 17th of August, where he decided to make the long drive back up to his native northeast in order to spend his 32nd birthday the following day with his mother. As he drove his yellow Austin Allegro northwards along the M1 motorway in the early hours, I remember my uncle having one many years ago, he was suddenly overcome by the powerful urges that had turned him into the monster that police of three forces were now searching for. And as he approached the junction of the M1 and the M18 in South Yorkshire, the motorway that leads to the A1 and to North East England, he spotted the lights of the farming village of Brampton and Llanmorthan in the distance. It was 2:45 a.m. and the opportunity seemed too good for him to miss. So, as traffic on the motorway was fairly quiet at that time, he pulled onto the hard shoulder, and when he thought the coast was clear for him, reversed his car far back into a small clump of trees just off the motorway. So far back that he inadvertently scraped the rear panel of his car on a branch. After snapping off several branches to cover the vehicle, taking particular care to cover the windscreen to prevent any headlight glare, he went to the boot of the vehicle and selected the tools of his trade. Screwdriver, fur-lined leather gloves, shotgun, he had this time placed it into the boot of his car rather than bury it, before he improvised the crude mask he favoured, cutting the leg off a pair of green overalls, fashioning eye and mouth holes in it, and knotting it at the top. Such an unholy sight then crossed the motorway and headed off towards the village. At the first house he earmarked for an attack, he was reportedly driven off by the barking of two fierce dogs, but spotted another house across a field that seemed to offer a good opportunity, finding when he arrived there that his luck couldn't have been better. The family who lived in the property, one account refers to them as the Boys family, whilst another refers to them as the Elliots, had only the day before had painters and decorators in, and a downstairs window frame had been glossed and left open to dry. Swiftly and silently, the fox was in the house. Once again, at 3:15 a.m., innocent people were awakened to find a masked man holding a gun, and as he pulled the bedclothes off them, their nightmare was just beginning. As in a previous attack, two children slept in the next room, mercifully unaware of the terror being played out just a few yards along the landing. In short, sharp commands, threatening to shoot if either so much as made a sound, the fox tied and gagged the couple with their own clothing, tying one of the couple's legs together with a length of washing line, the wife's other leg to the bed, and then securing her 42-year-old husband to the bedside cabinet and the bedpost. He then began to sexually assault his 36-year-old wife, and when her husband protested, he was viciously struck in the face with a shotgun. The fox then fastened the wife's hands above her head, as was his favoured way of tying a female victim, and then raped her. Following a cursory search of the house, where he stole £38 that he found, he cut the telephone lines and returned to the bedroom. Several sources then claim that the fox made his victim shower to remove trace evidence of himself, and before leaving, used a hairbrush from the dressing table, carefully brushing through his victim's body hair to remove further traces. He then cut out a large square of the bottom bedsheet which had been soiled by semen, gathered that and the hairbrush, and then slipped back out of the house, hurrying through the dew-soaked fields back to where he had hidden his car. On the way, he made a half-hearted attempt to bury both the piece of bedsheet and the hairbrush, and then before he reached the car, also buried the shotgun wrapped in a plastic bag. Now, one point of ambiguity here about this through researching is as to whether it was loaded or not, or was even intact. Sources claim variously that it was and it wasn't, and it was buried intact or had been broken into parts. But what can be ascertained is that between the site of the attack and where he parked his car, the shotgun certainly was hurriedly buried. Also, sources claim variously that he buried both his crude mask and both gloves, or that he abandoned these at the side of the motorway, hoping that they wouldn't stand out amongst the dirt and debris that littered the roadside. It's also claimed that he dropped one of these gloves, or it was found the following day, hanging in a tree. But what is omnipresent throughout all accounts, though, is that as the fox then continued on his journey north, he was in a state of jubilance. He felt invincible and was convinced that he'd taken every precaution to remove all traces of himself. He was still jubilant when at 6:10 a.m. he stopped at a motorway transport cafe and enjoyed a hearty breakfast, following which he stopped to grab a few hours sleep in his car before arriving at his mother's home at about 11 a.m. However, he had actually made a series of catastrophic mistakes that were ultimately to lead to his capture. When the alarm had been raised by the couple at Brampton and Limorthen, police were almost instantly considering that despite the significant distance, their attacker could be the elusive fox, by then Britain's most wanted man, and details of who had been telexed to every police force in the country. It was the same MO, same physical description, even down to the fact that the couple were convinced he was a Geordie, having the same accent as their gardener, who was from the northeast. In the early morning light, police were soon able to discover tracks that the fox had made when fleeing from the house, and spotting a number of broken off saplings in the copse aside the motorway, were soon able to identify where his car had been parked from how the saplings were broken off, before discovering tyre tracks and a number of footprints. The offence in Brampton and the fox's trail of terror were firmly linked later that day, and knowing that this hiding place amongst the trees could be a goldmine of evidence when examined, detectives were sure that the spot would yield more forensic clues. But with traffic rushing past just yards away, and the very real possibility that the man they sought would be passing by again, as he seemed to favour particular areas as he had done in Edlesborough, or perhaps only to retrieve his shotgun, detectives had problems. They needed to thoroughly search the area, but they didn't want to inconvenience drivers by closing the motorway, and didn't want to scare off a potentially returning fox. In cooperation with the traffic branch of South Yorkshire Police, officers hunting the fox hit upon the perfect solution. There was a media blackout. The inside lane on the M18 junction was coned off for a stretch some distance either side of the spot where the car had been hidden, and the aftermath of a road accident was staged there. Police cars with flashing lights parked on the hard shoulder. Two or three damaged cars from a breaker's yard were brought in to add authenticity, and ambulances were even borrowed, with search officers dressed in paramedic-style clothing or as motorway maintenance engineers, all to disguise the search that would appear to the casual rubbernecking driver as being the clear-up of the scene of an accident, not the search of a crime scene. It was to pay off big time, for along this route between crime scene and car, search teams were soon to discover the gloves that had been discarded, the homemade mask, the hairbrush and piece of semen-stained bedsheet, hidden but not hidden well enough, as well as some 300 yards away, the shotgun. Reportedly, the fox had even left the £38 he had stolen in the bag too, in such a hurry to bury the gun. Now, the shotgun was left in situ it being thought that the fox would certainly come back for this, and taking care to leave the scene as undisturbed as possible, police installed a hidden infrared remote control camera capable of giving pin-sharp images trained on the cops, along with sensors to detect movement and sound, and a team of officers equipped with binoculars fitted with light intensifiers were stationed there to keep watch, should he return. As one officer described later, "Not even a rabbit could move without us knowing. We had to keep everything secret. If anything had leaked to the press or television, he would never have returned." Now, it transpired later that the fox didn't return to the spot, and the operation was abandoned after a few days. But by then, the most crucial evidence had already been recovered from the car park site. During the disguised search, forensic officers examining and measuring the damage to the vegetation at the scene, beginning with the broken lower branches of two sycamore trees at the entrance, discovered at the very back of the copse where the ground began to slope down, slivers of paint adhering to the underside of a branch, suggesting that a vehicle had scraped it. Now, the branch was some 45 inches off the ground, and this fact, in conjunction with the shape and position of the paint sliver, suggested that the branch had been pushed up by something resembling the sloping pillar of a car with a blunt back end, like a hatchback, but categorically not the flat back of a van. Further, it had to be the rear pillar of a vehicle too, because the bonnet of a car would stick out too far, and had it scraped a windscreen pillar, there would have been tire marks in the earth just beyond the tree, but there was none, suggesting that it had been reversed in. Meanwhile, polarized light microscopy tests, a process involving the use of polarized light which creates vibrations only moving in one direction and cannot be seen by humans normally, and which allows investigators to view the 3D composite of materials, were performed on the paint samples to try and determine their composition. Upon analysis, it was concluded that the paint was indeed a type of car paint, subsequently identified as index number 7919, Harvest Yellow, a colour used most frequently by the motor vehicle company British Leyland. More specifically, it had been used by them almost predominantly on one particular model of theirs, the Austin Allegro model, manufactured between May 1973 and August 1975, of which there were some 1,500 registered at the time. Yet, this is still an immense amount to look through, but police were soon to get a further break that would help them narrow this down further. When the media blackout was lifted and details of the Brampton attack appeared in the newspapers, lorry driver Sid Bunyan was stopped at a police roadblock on the M18 a week after the attack, and when spoken to, recalled seeing a vehicle stopping on the hard shoulder by the M18 junction as he was driving past there on the night of the attack, heading north. He said later, "It had remained in my mind because I remembered thinking how far the poor bloke probably had to go if he had broken down. Police told me they thought the evidence was vitally important. It's quite chilling to think the fox was somewhere near as I drove past that spot." Sid was the only driver stopped who recalled seeing a vehicle there on the evening of the attack, though unfortunately couldn't remember the make or the colour. Sid even agreed to and underwent hypnosis twice to see if he could provide any further details from his subconscious, and as a result, he described an Austin Allegro. He was unable to provide the full registration number, though he did recall it began with a J, meaning it was a Durham registered vehicle, but he could recall the colour, Harvest Yellow. So, police in the Triangle of Terror now had amassed, from the fox's attacks, a physical description of him, his estimated age, the accent that suggested he was from the northeast of England, his shoe size, his blood group, Group A, the fact that he was left-handed, the fact that pre-rapist he was an experienced and prolific burglar, and therefore would likely have come to police attention before, the fact that he lived within sensible commuting distance of Hertfordshire, Buckinghamshire and Bedfordshire, and now, the fact that he drove a yellow Austin Allegro vehicle. When all of this was collated by Metal Mickey, it threw up for police a list of some 3,011 possible suspects in this area alone, all of whom would need to be eliminated from the inquiry. This really was a race against the clock, for police were also aware of the very uncomfortable fact that the Fox had now moved north, and potentially, no one in the country was safe. Indeed, the media carried the very real warning to the whole nation from Detective Chief Superintendent Prickett. Keep your doors and your windows locked. Now, after the Brampton attack, the Fox had remained in his native northeast for more than a week, but hadn't taken a second off from his criminality. The day he'd arrived at his mother's, he had that afternoon visited his brother Kenny, who lived nearby, and had then visited the local woods he had spent so much time in as a boy to burn the clothing he had worn the previous evening. He had then had another sleep at his mother's house, and then just after 9 p.m, he went out. As a birthday treat to himself, the Fox was about to strike in the northeast. That evening, in the town of Peterlee, masked in his usual garb, though without his shotgun, of course, and instead wielding an iron bar, the Fox broke into an empty property in Furness Close before moving onto another nearby, where he attacked a woman named Yvonne Chow in her bedroom. However, Yvonne fought back and bit the Fox hard on his hand, causing him to strike her with the iron bar and to flee. Yvonne described later, "He pulled me so I was sitting up in bed and growled, 'Shut up.' I screamed in terror and he flung his arms around me. They were across my chest and his head was on my shoulder. His mouth was so close I could hear him breathing. I was hysterical with fear, but I knew I had to keep on screaming. I was petrified, but in a frenzy I bit him as hard as I could and kept on screaming." Now incidentally, Yvonne mistakenly believed her attacker was her landlord, John Webber, who it transpired later, following his arrest, bore a remarkable resemblance to the Fox. The stigma of such an accusation blighted John for a while afterwards, and even helped break up his marriage. The same night, at about midnight, mother and daughter Pauline and Karen Swan were heading to bed at home in Peterlee's Northam Drive, when Pauline suddenly screamed as the Fox loomed out of the darkness of the upstairs hallway. However, due to the barking of the family's Alsatian, Carla, he fled through the bedroom window. Pauline described later, "I was so stunned to see him standing there that my knees buckled and I dropped to the floor. Karen was behind me and she screamed. I was terrified, but I took a step towards him. I wasn't going to have this man in my house." A couple of days later, the Fox returned to the town and broke into another three houses, at some point even prowling around the home and garden of then Deputy Chief Constable of Durham, Tom Farmer. He had moved into somewhere he was very familiar with, the nearby village of Silksworth, by the bank holiday Monday of August the 27th, when he was chased from a house in Cannonsfield Close there by the owner, John Henderson, though the Fox got away. John recalled the following year, "After the Fox was arrested, I had an idea it was he who'd broken into my house. The only emotion I feel is one of anger, because I didn't catch him. I was half asleep at the time when I saw this masked man creeping up the stairs. I jumped out of bed and chased him downstairs, but he got out of the lounge window, which he'd forced open. If I'd caught him, he'd be in the hospital. He would have had to shoot me first before getting to my wife and child. All I felt at the time was anger because he'd broken into my home, and I still feel that way. Leslie is over the shock now, but she was very upset at the time, especially when we thought later it was the fox. The same night, in a house in Neasham Road in the nearby town of Seaham, Maureen Alderson was sleeping alone following a family barbecue at which her husband Trevor had drunk too much homemade wine and had become ill. Her then 5-year-old son Paul was staying with relatives, and Maureen recalled later, "As I rolled over, I saw a figure crouching in the bedroom doorway. As I moved, he jumped onto the bed. He must have been kneeling on the bed because his face was just above me. All I could see was a light balaclava with just eye slits cut out. I said, 'Who is it?' But he put his hand over my mouth and said, 'Shut up, be quiet,' and waved a knife at me. It was a big kitchen knife with a 6-inch blade. Then he pulled the blankets back and put his hand on the top of my leg. I said, 'Get off,' and he did. I was surprised. But then he put his hand back in the same place. I said, 'Look, get off, you're not touching me.' And he raised the knife, but I said, 'I don't care, you're not touching me.' Then I said, 'Just go away, I'll lie here until you've gone. I won't make a move.' And he said, 'Okay, I'm going,' and pushed me back. Looking back, it seems amazing that I refused to give in to him. But at the time, I just knew there was no way I was going to let that man have me. I just lay there until I thought he was away, and then I catapulted out of bed and ran around the house, turning every light on. I hadn't been too frightened while he was there for some reason, but after he'd gone, I was hysterical. I was just petrified. I woke up my husband and we went round the house, but nothing was out of place. It affected me for a while afterwards. When I went to bed and closed my eyes, I imagined his head looming over me. But I think I'm over it now, and I don't mind talking about it. It doesn't raise the fears anymore. I'm just angry now. I'd like my husband to get hold of him. He said if he did, he'd kill him, and I'd like to be there when he does." The fox headed back down to his familiar triangle of terror following this, and throughout the first week of September, committed several burglaries, mainly in the Milton Keynes area, though there were no reported sexual offences. What was to be his final attack occurred on the 8th of September in the Bradwell area of here, the attack against Hilary Lee that I opened part one of the tale by describing. 3 days after Hilary's attack, Detective Constables Dick Hanks and Nigel Tompkins arrived at an address in Kentish Town in London, number 65 Osney Crescent, to follow up a routine TIE, trace, interview, eliminate, of one of the 3,011 suspects generated by computer, the 580th that had been seen to that point, and one of dozens that they had seen themselves. The man had formerly lived in the Aylesbury area, but had only recently relocated to the top 2 floors of number 65 with his wife and child. One report claims that his sister lived with them also. When they rounded the corner, they were taken aback to see a man matching the general physical description of the fox working on a blue Ford Capri parked outside the property, behind which was parked a yellow Austin Allegro, a bumper sticker on which read, "Don't follow me, I'm lost too." The owner of the vehicle, the person they'd come to speak to, 32-year-old Malcolm Fairley, who hailed from Sunderland and so had a northeast accent, seemed unfazed by speaking to the officers and didn't even balk when one of the detectives, looking further at the Allegro, noticed a scratch mark to the rear panel around about the same height that it had been ascertained the fox's car would have been scratched at following the attack up in Brampton. With mounting excitement, sure that they may just have discovered the elusive fox, DC Hanks spotted an opening to ascertain his suspicions further. Spotting Fairley's wristwatch on the dashboard of the vehicle, The detective told him to do himself a favour and put it back on to save it being stolen, which fairly did, strapping it to his right wrist. At that point, at 7:30 p.m, he was arrested on suspicion of rape, and before he was taken back to the Dunstable headquarters for questioning, the boot of the Allegro was opened. Inside were two sets of green overalls, one with the leg missing, having been cut off, and a screwdriver with very distinct markings on its head. Gotcha. The fox had been snared. Soon after his arrival at Dunstable, Fairley had confessed to more than 80 crimes he had committed as the fox, those you have heard described, and further burglaries, saying, "I never wanted to hurt anybody. I cannot help myself. I just got into the habit of it. It just went on and got worse and worse. I'm disappointed in myself. It just weren't me. Just weren't me." However, he expressed no remorse for what he'd done and spoke dispassionately about his crimes. Detective Superintendent Prickett recalled, "I asked him at one stage about what he thought about a woman he had raped. I was looking for some sort of sorrow. After a pause, he said, 'Yes, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I've been caught.'" Another detective recalled, "He spoke as though he'd just gone into Woolies to buy something and then walked out. He is a quiet, unassuming little man. When we interviewed him, it was very difficult to think that he was such an evil person. He showed very little remorse and admitted that had we not caught him, he would still be out attacking people now." Fairley admitted to police that he had felt empowered by his acquisition of the shotgun, stating, "The gun is king. When I got the gun, I feel I could get what I wanted." On the occasion that one of his victims was shot in the hand, Fairley said the gun merely went off due to his inexperience of firearms, and on subsequent occasions when he used it to threaten his victims, claimed it was never loaded. He never had again after blowing off Bernard Jackson's fingers. Now, we shall never know if this is true, as I said, there are conflicting reports as to whether the gun discovered off the M18 was loaded or not when it was found. On the 14th of September 1984, Fairley appeared before Dunstable Magistrates Court, where in a brief hearing of just a few minutes, he faced three charges of rape, two of burglary and one of possession of a firearm, and was remanded in custody to Leicester Prison to await trial. An angry crowd of hundreds were baying for him as he was led out from the court underneath a blanket before being sped away in a marked police car. News of the arrest and charges against the man for the fox crimes were the excuse in the areas of the Triangle of Terror affected for celebration, and more than one party was held, often attracting hundreds of people. Even the three youths who had 2 months before had their lives changed so much at Edlesborough by the fox attended one such bash at the Axe and Compass pub, feeling they could now finally begin to try and move on without the threat of the fox returning. So, who was the man accused of being the fox, Malcolm Fairley? Born in Orr Avenue in the Sunderland village of New Silksworth in August 1952, the youngest of nine children born to Minor Ambrose and his wife Hannah Fairley, Malcolm Fairley, or Mally as he was known to his family, was an unremarkable child who was described as a somewhat lonely, shy and introverted youth due to speech defects he had, and which consequently was bullied at school for, and so frequently truanted, preferring to spend time sleeping rough in the nearby Tunstall Hills with his Alsatian dog. He left school at age 15 with a terrible attendance record, illiterate, innumerate, and believing himself sexually inadequate. A brief job in a dairy was short-lived following this, as was brief employment as a trainee spot welder at a washing machine manufacturing company in Newton Aycliffe, though he held a job at a coal washing plant for some 16 months following leaving here. But regular employment didn't seem to interest Fairley. Instead, his interests more taken up by three things: the cartoons and American gangster movies he loved to watch, his heroes being George Raft and James Cagney, motorcycles, and the lure of being a successful professional criminal. He had first come to the attention of police from the age of 15, when he had appeared at juvenile court for theft, and beginning from age 18, with his first appearance at adult court, over the next 13 years was to collect several convictions and prison sentences galore for offences ranging from theft to ABH. In fact, Fairley was to miss half of his son Paul's first year alive due to him being in Borstal for the remainder of 1972. He'd met the boy's mother, Joan Sinclair, at the Top Rank Ballroom in Sunderland in April 1971, and the two had married after she fell pregnant with Paul, but the marriage was a stormy one due to Fairley's criminality. As I say, he was a habitual yet unsuccessful thief, Joan recalled later. When we were courting, he was always smartly dressed. He had nice shirts and ties. They were probably stolen, but I wasn't to know that. Her mother Mary added, he had a way with him as if butter wouldn't melt in his mouth. Any woman could take to him. I thought he was fine when I first met him, but I soon realised different. He was a bit of a dance hall Romeo, the kind of lad that girls could fancy. The marriage ended after less than 2 years, though, as I said, because Fairley couldn't stop stealing things. Reportedly, he even swiped the £100 that Joan's mother had put together for their wedding cake, and on another occasion, recalling a raid upon the house in Skirlaw Road in Newton Aycliffe where Fairley and Joan lived, every item found there was stolen from a recent spate of Fairley's burglaries, even reportedly the couple's three-piece suite. He'd not tried to dispose of anything that he had stolen, he had merely just took it home and kept it. The marriage was also interspersed by long periods of separation, both enforced when Fairley was in custody, and voluntarily when he would go back to his mother's, and after just 2 years, he and Joan split. Following a three-year separation, their marriage was dissolved in 1976. Though surprisingly, Fairley was awarded custody of the couple's son Paul, after he told a family court, quite falsely, that Joan had problems with alcohol. By August of 1977, Fairley had married again, this time to a woman named Georgina Bell, after a child was born to the couple, daughter Frances, in 1976. Another son, Gary, followed in 1978, and a close friend of Georgina, Mary Middleton, said later, they seemed an ordinary couple. She worshipped the ground he walked on and would do anything for him. However, others perceived the marriage differently. A former neighbour of the Fairleys when they lived at No. 7 House Terrace in Concord in Washington, Mona Collier, said following his arrest, he was not very neighbourly. He would always try to avoid speaking. If he came out of his house and saw you, he would turn around and go back inside. He would only speak if you spoke first. He never looked at you straight. He would always look away. He and Georgina had lots of rows and fights. Indeed, there were several accounts of furious rows and violence in the marriage, again sprouting from Fairley's criminality. He even reportedly had, at House Terrace, hidden compartments underneath the stairs for storing stolen goods, and his inability or unwillingness to stop it. By all accounts, Fairley was good with his hands and a methodical, accomplished mechanic, and could have walked into such a lawful profession, but this lure of petty crime was too great for him to, and instead, the convictions kept mounting up. 1979, a probation order for theft. June 1981, an 18-month prison sentence at Durham Crown Court for 5 counts of burglary, after Fairley had asked for 37 other offences to be taken into consideration. And February 1983, 240 hours community service for theft. After a year's unemployment, later in 1983, he went south to seek work in Buckinghamshire, living for a while with his eldest brother Kingsley in the Leighton Buzzard area and undertaking a number of casual labouring jobs with a number of companies from Berkhamsted to Milton Keynes, supplementing his income by partaking in burglary, theft and car crimes. Always nomadic, none of these jobs had lasted more than a few weeks, nor had the job as a farm labourer at Little Tring, which ended after 3 months when he took the roof off a private car with a digger, or a role at the Schweppes drinks plant in Aylesbury, which he'd left after 3 weeks and returned to the North East. Determined to try again though, in February 1984, he returned to the same area and found lodgings at Aylesbury Lodge, a £40 per week hostel in Aylesbury, from where, the following month, he began his career as the Fox in earnest, committing at least 12 burglaries in the Leighton Buzzard and Tring areas. By the time Georgina and Paul moved down to Aylesbury to be with him, though leaving the younger two children, who reports are that Fairley used to ill-treat, back in the northeast with Georgina's mother, and they moved into an £18.50 a night double room at the hostel in May 1984, the Fox had already been born. By mid-August of that year, after a holiday in the Scottish Highlands where, after his arrest, a widely published photograph of Fairley had been taken, by the time they returned, the hunt for Fairley was so intense that the family moved to Kentish Town in North London, though this almost fanatical desire to break into houses had stayed with him. And despite the mass focus in the Triangle of Terror, he made frequent return visits to the area at night. He told detectives later that he had only merely intended to rob following his attack in Brampton, but they are certain that had he found a woman in the homes raided, she would have been subjected to a sex ordeal, as was shown with Hilary Lee. It transpired that at the height of the hunt for him, Fairley had also stayed for a couple of nights at the Mill Hill home in London of his niece, who was married to a serving police officer in the Met, and had even told his son Paul, who had expressed his fears about the Fox to his father in a teasing manner, "You better watch out, or the Fox will get you." Only a week later, 12-year-old Paul, who was devoted to his father, was to hear the news that the Fox had been caught. His relief turned to horror when his stepmother told him, "They say it's Dad." Monstrous that, eh? Anna Haywood, the wife of Fairley's nephew Harry, recalled, "Paul refused to believe her. He said, 'My dad wouldn't do anything like that. I know he wouldn't.' Gina told him, 'You've got to be the man of the family now.' Then, as he packed his little case to go and stay with relatives, he broke down in tears. Paul really loved his father. They used to fly model planes together." Indeed, while planning his catalogue of crimes atop Ivanhoe Beacon, Fairley had often been accompanied by his son Paul. Georgina, meanwhile, had over the previous 6 years known that her husband was a compulsive burglar and had grown used to him going missing in the small hours, but she could never have imagined that the devoted, caring father she regarded Fairley as, the man who came home early in the morning and made love with her, had only hours before been sadistically attacking couples sexually. Amazingly, following his arrest, she even promised to stand by him, telling relatives, "He's still my husband, still the father of my children, and I still love him." I ask you, can you imagine how you would feel in such a situation. In the days that followed Fairley's arrest, when he had admitted to her being the fox, Georgina had a mental breakdown and spent time in a psychiatric hospital. Very often, they are the forgotten victims of such offences, aren't they? The unsuspecting families of the offender. Ahead of his trial, in the last few weeks of the summer, knowing it would be his last days out travelling around for a long, long time, Fairley, escorted by detectives, took them on a trip around both the Triangle of Terror and the places in the northeast that he had struck as the fox, pointing out the locations of his offences for confirmation, and during the journey recalling to them some of the cunning that had kept him at large for so long. For example, how he would leave his car up to 2 miles from the scene of any attacks and make his way there on foot across fields and through woods, relying on memory to recall the routes he had earlier planned from Ivanhoe Beacon, or how he would, after each attack, bury the shotgun he used to eliminate the risk of him being stopped with it at any potential roadblocks. Though he did recall minute details about offences, such as being disturbed by a child or having trouble with a window at scenes that he'd identified, never once did he say he was sorry, one detective said later. It seemed incredible that he was made of the same flesh and blood as other human beings. I'll never forget how unfeeling that man was about the horrendous things he'd done. The trial of Malcolm Fairley began at St Albans Crown Court on the 26th of February 1985 before presiding Mr Justice Caulfield, and where, dressed in a grey pullover, black trousers and open-necked prison issue shirt, and flanked by 5 prison officers, he faced 15 charges from the previous year, namely, April the 11th, 1984, entering a house at Linslade. April the 11th, indecent assault of a 73-year-old woman. May the 10th, burglary at Cheddington, stealing a shotgun and £450. May the 10th, indecently assaulting a male. June the 6th, entering a house at Grove Park, Tring, with intent to steal and to rape a woman, armed. June the 9th, same charges at a house in Heath and Reach. June the 9th, entering a house in Leighton Buzzard, same charges. June the 9th, GBH on a man. June the 9th, possessing a shotgun with intent to endanger life. July the 6th, entering a house at Linslade with the same charges as June the 9th. July the 10th, rape. July the 13th, rape. August the 17th, rape. August the 18th, entering a house at Peterlee. September the 9th, entering a house at Bradwell Village to rape. Fairley admitted all of these charges, bar counts 8 and 9, that of GBH and possessing a shotgun with intent to endanger life, claiming the gun had gone off and injured Bernard Jackson only due to his own inexperience with firearms, and count 15, entering a house with intent to steal and rape in Bradwell Village, pleading guilty only to intent to steal. He also asked for a further 79 crimes between March and September 1984 to be taken into consideration. Because of the strength of the other charges he had admitted to, these were accepted and were allowed to remain on file. Ahead of sentencing, John Alliott KC, prosecuting, then recounted to the court the story of the fox's crime spree, as you've heard throughout the tale. But it was left to Fairley's defence counsel, armed with 5 different pre-trial medical reports, to explain the one thing the court needed to know. Why? Why does a prolific burglar make the jump to serial sex attacker? The answer, it was argued, was Fairley's addiction to pornography. Fairley's defence counsel, Michael Connell KC, argued his poor education had contributed to his actions that he was easily susceptible, and that he was trying to imitate what he had seen on the video screen, a reference to the violent pornographic films he had become addicted to viewing. An argument backed up by each of the medical reports that had been prepared upon him before his trial. He came to believe that people he saw in the films he viewed, particularly a horrendous-sounding 1975 rape and revenge film called Sex Wish, which fell within Section 3 of the Obscene Publications Act and which showed simulated sex acts, a film that could be confiscated but shop owners and distributors could not be prosecuted for selling, were enjoying themselves on screen, and whilst burgling in April 1984 and faced with a vulnerable victim, he had decided to emulate these. Chief Superintendent Brian Prickett had told the court, when he had asked Fairley why he had committed his crimes, I quote, "He turned round and said calmly that he'd seen it all on videos. He had seen sex with animals, and he had seen shots of group sex. He was motivated by the videos and wanted to find out what these acts were really like." There are just no words, eh? In mitigation, Mr. Connell told the court, "This is not a man guilty of gratuitous sadistic violence. That does distinguish his case from some others who come before the courts. This man is not completely to blame for his actions. He was subject to outside influences for which he could not compensate. He has a very inadequate personality, the consequence which is that he has no clear idea of right or wrong. He has very little insight into the quality or weakness of his actions. His personality and physical defects caused him to be more susceptible to evil external influences. By that, I have in mind videos. Some of his actions were, of course, designed to satisfy himself, but he still believed that they might be able to satisfy other people too. Given his inadequacy, he is more entitled to the mercy of this court than others might be." When commenting on medical reports handed to him by the defence counsel, the judge had said, "All these reports emphasise the relevance of pornography in this case, every single one. I am satisfied that you are a decadent advertisement for the evil pornographers, but they will want to forget you as one of their worst casualties." Then passing sentence upon Fairley, Mr. Justice Caulfield told him, "There are degrees of wickedness and depravity beyond the capacity of contemptuous description. Your crimes fall within this category. Crimes for which there is no exculpation. Crimes which left your victims in utter terror and with lifelong frightening burdens on their memories. You desecrated and defiled men and women, old and youthful, in their own homes, which you then pillaged." He then told Fairley he was sentencing him to the maximum term on each of the 13 charges he had admitted, namely 3 life sentences for rape, 3 life sentences for burglary with intent to rape, 14 years on each charge of entering a house with intent to steal at Linslade, Cheddington, Tring, Peterlee and Milton Keynes, 10 years for indecently assaulting the farm worker in Cheddington, and a 2-year sentence for the indecent assault on a 73-year-old widow, his first known sexual attack. Fairley showed barely any emotion as the sentences were passed upon him, and said nothing, merely staring straight forward at the judge whilst fidgeting nervously with his fingers behind his back. He was then taken away to begin his sentence, beginning prison life with up to 3 years of assessment at Wormwood Scrubs Prison in West London, his first 12 months being spent in isolation as prison officers decided the risk he faced from other prisoners as a sex offender. Now incidentally, 3 days after Fairley's sentencing, the same judge at the same court sentenced another rapist, Alvin Black, to 10 years imprisonment for rape and burglary, a crime in which Black had raped a young nurse the previous summer, and told her he was the fox. Mr. Justice Caulfield told him as he passed sentence, "One fox is enough in a lifetime." You couldn't agree more, could you? Following the fox's conviction, a senior officer from Operation Peanut, Detective Chief Inspector John Branscombe, said, "At times, I had to pinch myself to remind myself of the crimes this man had committed, because he seemed so ordinary." With the Yorkshire Ripper inquiry, it was different. Although people were terrified, they at least had the feeling that they were safe in their own homes. But with a fox, it was precisely in their own homes that they were most vulnerable. That made him a much more terrifying threat. Fairley did appeal his conviction, but on Tuesday the 29th of October of that year, it was upheld at the Court of Appeal by a panel of judges led by Lord Chief Justice Lord Lane. In the late 1990s, following fears of the families of his victims that Fairley was about to be released from prison, no minimum term having been set for him, and them contacting the Home Office, an insider issued a statement saying, "I want it known that Malcolm Fairley is not being considered for release or parole in the foreseeable future, although you can never say someone is going to be imprisoned indefinitely." Though a rumour surfaced in 2012 that Fairley had been released from prison and was living under an assumed name in an undisclosed location, no evidence was found to support this claim, and as late as 2019, reports online from someone claiming to be the partner of one of his children seemingly confirmed he had not been released. Today, he is believed to still be a serving prisoner, now one of the UK's longest. There were several points of note following Fairley's imprisonment back in 1985, beginning just the following month, when Bedfordshire's Chief Constable Andrew Sloan awarded commendations to the unfortunately named ISIS of Bristol, Microdata of Hemel Hempstead, Huntington Forensic Science Lab, the West Yorkshire Computer System, and the Home Office Wireless Department at Cheveley, all organisations who had helped in tracking the fox. It was also reported that Bedfordshire Police used the fox case as a springboard to setting up a working party that gained permission to install the county's first sexual offences suites in a converted flat in Dunstable Police Station. One quickly followed at Luton Police Station, in the former caretaker's flat there, and a similar one was set up in Bedford. It really was the fledgling start of specialisation within detection of sexual offences in Bedfordshire, and indeed, in policing. And today, the force has the Emerald Team, a dedicated team for the investigation of rape and sexual offences, with specially trained police officers and staff whose role is committed to victim engagement. Back in 1985, the force were also at the time using footage filmed of crime scenes during the Fox investigation to make their very own video nasty, though this time one to be used as a training aid to train detectives in specialist techniques that had been perfected during the investigation. In September of that year, it was reported that car dealer Tony Potton, who had bought for £400 the Fox's Harvest Yellow Allegro, which had by then been released for sale after examination by police, and was offering it for sale for £1,000, a scheme the relatives of Fairley's victims branded sick and tasteless. Defending himself, Potton said, "I suppose it is a gimmick and a bit macabre, but it's an investment. It's not as if anything happened in the car. Maybe someone will get a kick out of driving it around. I'm going to hold on to it in case somebody makes a film about the fox. They might want to use his real car, and I might get a good deal for it, either by selling it or renting it. But I am open to offers." Now, it's a bit callous-like, isn't it? But you'll always get one. What can you say? The fox case is also very likely the inspiration for a 1987 three-part episode of Scottish TV detective series Taggart, called The Killing Philosophy, which deals with a masked individual called the Glasgow Bowman, who begins a spree of rape armed with a crossbow, in which he moves furniture around in the properties that he invades, empties the fridge, and, not peanuts, but has a penchant for baked beans, though unlike the fox, he soon gravitates to murder. Now, I haven't watched Taggart in many years since I was a kid, but I remembered this episode vividly, and so sought it out and watched it as part of researching this tale. That's how dedicated I am, and it passed an hour or two. And it was quite good, actually, as well. It was also reported in 2017 that the man known as Britain's most violent prisoner, Charles Arthur Salvador, former Charles Ali Ahmed, who was born Michael Gordon Peterson, but is most widely known as Charles Bronson, had featured fairly as one of the subjects of his Dirty Dozen, a selection of 12 artworks which includes nightmarish depictions of prison life and that is themed around some of Britain's most notorious criminals that he has met over the years. And it was sold to a Jersey Islander for the sum of £545,000. Though Salvador received no profit from this sale, I must add. Now, I won't go too much into Salvador here because he is a whole different story altogether. Look out for an episode that tells his story coming later this series. But he is an acclaimed and accomplished artist and even changed his surname from Bronson to Salvador in tribute to painter Salvador Dali. And this Dirty Dozen artwork collection are each signed by thumbprints from a nosebleed suffered by Salvador whilst in jail. Now, as an example of the notoriety fairly holds to be held amongst this dozen, the other 11, none of whom really need any introduction, are Moore's murderers Ian Brady and Myra Hindley, Fred West, Levi Belfield, Reggie and Ronnie Cray, Harold Shipman, Peter Sutcliffe, Donald Nielsen, the Black Panther, Patrick McKay, and Edward Paisnell, the Beast of Jersey, who we met in the second ever episode of The Enthusiast. That is some group of evil to belong to, that, isn't it? As I said back at the beginning of part one, I am amazed that it has taken me almost 7 years to get around to covering the case of the fox on The Enthusiast, and what a disturbing yet fascinating tale it has been to bring to you. A very strange individual indeed is Fairley, isn't he? And for crimes of such magnitude, for the fear he instilled as the fox in such a large area, the gall with which he returned to the same areas night after night, one who warrants still being a serving prisoner today, regardless of age or infirmity. I mean, how many people did he leave with life sentences of their own? What do you think? I would love, as always, hearing any thoughts and feedback that you might have on the tale I've brought you in Triangle of Terror, which you can do so in the thread that's now up in the show's Facebook discussion group, or through any of the show's social media links. I told you, nothing has changed following my break. It is business as usual all the way. With that, it's time for me to wrap up and shut up, and it's on to the next one. Once again, it is so good being back with you all, and thank you for getting the show to Series 9. It is still mind-bending, that is, I can't tell you. All that remains for me to say then is that I've been, I still am, and hopefully still will be Paul, the true crime enthusiast. Wishing you all good and safe times, and I shall speak to you very soon. Take care all, thanks very much for joining me in the peaks. Stay safe, and goodbye for now.